This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
What all this messiness in Washington is doing to the rest of the economy. Plus, where do you go to make new friends? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, October 20th. Good to have you with us. Another week, another couple of rounds of drama in the U.S. Congress, the implications of which we'll get to in a moment. We also got a slew of other economic indicators this week, plus a speech courtesy of one Jerome Powell. So to recap the 5 days gone by, we have Jordan Holman at the New York Times, Sudeep Reddy at Politico. Hey, you two.
Hi, Kimberly.
Hey, Kimberly.
Sudeep, we are both here in Washington just watching this very interesting activity on the Hill. The House is still speakerless, has been for a couple weeks now. Is this starting to show up elsewhere in the economy?
I don't know that what's happening in Congress is actually showing up. I just now pulled up the approval ratings of Congress. They've actually never been good. No surprise. There are about 26% of Republicans and Democrats have a favorable view of Congress. So it's a very low bar already, and we're not really expecting Congress to deliver all that much. Yes, there is the worry about a shutdown coming up about a month from now. Yes, we've gotten past the debt ceiling worries. I'm not sure that the other things that are on the agenda are really at a level that they're going to weigh down the economy. There are, of course, other things coming from Washington that weigh on Americans, including the Federal Reserve and high interest rates and all of that. Mm-hmm. It's just that Congress has reduced itself to absurdity for so long that it's hard to actually see the impact of it anymore.
Not to spend too much time in that absurdity, but some folks on the Hill are talking about just keeping Speaker Pro Tem McHenry in place for a while just to get some things done. What would that do? I mean, would people be game for that in terms of the markets and such?
Yeah, absolutely. If we end up with an actually functioning Congress with somebody who can open the chamber and pass legislation, that would be a step forward from where we've been for the last 2 weeks. And because because expectations have been so low, getting anybody in place would probably be a step forward. But Patrick McHenry, who is as Speaker Pro Tem, just happened to get the job because he was on Kevin McCarthy's backup list in case he was incapacitated. He's in the job now, but he runs the House Financial Services Committee. He's known as the voice on the economy, and he's kind of seen as the adult in the room. He wasn't always that. He was a flamethrower for a while when he got into Congress, but he is seen as the person who is kind of the chief emissary to Wall Street and the type of person that I think business would be very comfortable with if they could get to that point. But that probably actually lowers his odds of lasting in the job in the long run in this particular House GOP.
Jordan, I want to get to more retail stuff in a minute, but just quickly, is this showing up at all when you're talking to sources?
You know, not really in terms of its impact on retail. I think broadly, just kind of it adds to the uncertainty of it all. It's like, oh, it's one more thing that could maybe either spook people from shopping or just not feel great about the future, which is never a good thing for businesses.
So sticking with retail, we had retail sales numbers out this week. Justin Ho was reporting for us that these headline numbers may not be as robust as they look because they're not adjusted for inflation. What was your take on the retail sales numbers this week?
Yeah, when I was talking to analysts, they've definitely flagged that as well. Like, it looks very robust, but we have to remember it's not adjusted for inflation. Obviously, we're still dealing with relatively high inflation. The other thing that analysts flagged to me is that, you know, September is just a big time for shopping. It's back to school season, and that retail is cyclical. So we shouldn't expect kind of this idea that we want to see that, or the Fed wants to see that number come down. Shouldn't expect that people wouldn't still shop during this time of year, that they always shop.
I mean, it seems like throughout this whole process, people continue to shop regardless of interest rates, regardless of what's going on in the economy or the world. I mean, Citi, Fed Chair Powell was signaling yesterday that there may be another rate hike coming in the future because this economy seems stubbornly, maybe even surprisingly resilient to all these hikes we've had so far. What were your takeaways from what he had to say?
You know, I think Chair Powell has been just really surprised. And there was a point a year ago where just about every economist who makes economic projections thought there was going to be a recession in the coming year. A full year has passed. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen that. We have strong retail sales. We have a strong job market. We have strong GDP figures. We have even at 8% mortgage rates, the highest since the year 2000, 8% for a 30-year fixed mortgage, you still have the housing market saying surprisingly resilient and not falling apart at that point. And so the resilience is seen across the board. And at some point, the Fed knows its mission is to make sure inflation comes down and stays down. And so they're going to keep delivering the beatings until inflation improves. And so that's where he stands. And we should just at least be pleased that we've been so resilient in all of this.
You know, Jordan, on this resiliency thing, you had a story out last week looking at hiring for the holidays, and you were saying that things are looking a bit softer there. What do you think that signals about resiliency and where consumers are right now?
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic that's happening because, like, large retailers like Macy's and Dick's say that they're going to hire less for the holiday season, their peak season. But the context there is that they've been hiring all year, which speaks to the strong labor market that we're still seeing. And overall, they don't want to overhire because everyone's still a bit skittish. Like, even though that recession hasn't come, businesses just want to be a little bit more conservative when it comes to adding people on their payroll. So that's kind of the big takeaway when we move into November and December, which is the biggest time of year for retailers.
Have you started your holiday shopping yet, Jordan?
No, I'm still thinking about my Halloween costume.
What about you, Sudeep?
We've got Halloween candy, and that's about it. So, no, we have not gotten to the actual Christmas season yet.
All right. Well, that's Sudeep Reddy at Politico and Jordan Holman at The New York Times. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Kimberly.
Thanks, Kimberly.
All right, On Wall Street today, the stock market was not too happy with what was going down, or I guess I should say up, with treasuries today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You know, when it comes to the global supply chain, what can seem like relatively small changes can have pretty significant downstream consequences. Case in point, China announced today it would start requiring stricter permits on the exports of graphite, a key mineral for making pencils. But it's not just more expensive number twos we have to worry about. Graphite is also important for making electric vehicle batteries, and China produces two-thirds of the world's natural graphite, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. Marketplace's Matt Levin has more on why this matters.
graphite is kind of like the less attractive sibling of a diamond. Chemically, they're both pure carbon, and both are formed because of high pressure and temperatures. And while flaky, blackish-gray graphite won't be involved in any marriage proposals, it is key to all types of manufacturing.
From steel making to semiconductors to electric vehicle batteries.
Morgan Bazilian is a professor at the Colorado School of Mines. He says you basically can't build a lithium-ion battery without graphite, which means you can't build an EV without graphite. That's a lesson China learned decades ago when it invested heavily in graphite mining and refining.
They do not have the world's largest reserves, but they do have the largest production.
Mozambique and Brazil produce some graphite, but way less than China does. Hugues Jacquemin is the CEO of Northern Graphite, the only company with a major working mine in North America, in Quebec. He says rising graphite prices will spur more investment, but it takes time to get a new mine up and running and through environmental clearances.
Yeah, it would take anything between 10 to 25 years from the moment you identify your deposit.
Graphite is just the latest flashpoint in the China-U.S. trade war. Mary Lovely at the Peterson Institute for International Economics says China is partly just retaliating. The Biden administration earlier this week restricted computer chip exports there.
I think it's a demonstration of its own power. You mess with me, I can mess with you.
And meanwhile, you can pencil in higher costs for EVs if you can find a cheap pencil. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Making the jump from car batteries to the cars themselves, the Biden administration recently proposed a rule to continue its crackdown on so-called junk fees by imposing penalties on the companies that don't show their full price up front. When it comes to extra fees, the rental car industry has its own share of those. Emily Stewart, a senior correspondent at Vox, wrote about how rental car fees can squeeze consumers and is here to tell us more. Emily, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, rental cars, we use them, we sometimes love them. Maybe what made you want to write about this?
To be honest, this is one that I hear about all of the time from readers and honestly from people in my life. And I hear about it from myself. I have never had a rental car experience that has been smooth. I will say that much.
Was there a specific incident that made you say, this is the time I'm going to dig into this?
I mean, right now, currently, a family friend actually just rented a car out in Denver and was looking at their receipt, and they were like, what in the world's going on? Like, the price of the rental car had basically doubled with all of the fees, and they sent me over their receipt, and just kind of bit by bit, I started to look what each one was, and I was honestly pretty surprised at what I found, because I think we really don't know how rental car fees work in a way that maybe we are a little bit more accustomed to, like, on tickets or flights. To some extent, at least.
In your piece, you list a couple of these fees: concession recovery fee, road safety, energy recovery fee. What are some of the fees that really jumped out to you as you were doing this reporting?
So I think it's important to point out that a lot of these fees are from state and local governments across the country. It is not popular for policymakers to raise taxes on their residents. It's a lot easier to raise taxes on tourists, right, on travelers. And so you will see all sorts of fees for highways or just random taxes that you don't quite understand. If a rental car agency is at an airport, the airport will charge that rental car agency money. That money gets charged to you. And then, of course, there are all the fees that show up once you're at the counter at the airport trying to figure out what to do in terms of, do you want extra car insurance or do you want to fill up gas your own or do you want us to fill up gas for you? Do you need a car seat? So there are all sorts of different fees that show up. Some of them are things you can't avoid. Some of them are things that you can.
Why aren't these fees and taxes included in the base rate?
That's, I think, the million-dollar question. I think right now, you know, at least rental car companies will tell you to a certain extent, it's like, we want to disclose this stuff, right? Like, we also don't want to take all of the blame that there are all these fees, that some of them really have nothing to do with us. We cannot tell the state of California or whatever that we're not going to, you know, charge these taxes. But at the same time, I think it's definitely fair to say it would be much better for consumers to just know how much everything was going to cost us right off the bat. I don't want to have to do math and go back and guess at how much everything might be.
So after doing all this reporting, what tips do you have for the rest of us when it comes to renting a car, things to avoid, things we need?
I mean, it's good to think about before you get to the counter. I think a lot about a few years ago, I was in Madison, Wisconsin, and I was not prepared to answer the insurance question. And at some point wound up in a back and forth with the agent over whether I thought a tree might fall on my car and I needed that kind of insurance. So I think it's a good idea to go in and know, like, how do I want to answer that question, the insurance question? But I think a lot of it really is, you know, trying to comparison shop and then just really doing your homework, which isn't the ideal answer, but it's kind of the best one we have for now.
How do you feel now when you walk up to the rental counter?
The last time I rented a car actually was like fairly smooth until I got to the parking lot. And the first two cars I got didn't work. The first one, the battery was dead. The second one had somebody else's luggage in it. Like, it's always, I feel bad because it is a hard industry, right? It has to be. Somebody picks up like a very big ticket item from you and you don't know where they go with it. But at the same time, really, even after I published this story, the amount of emails that I've gotten from readers with different horror stories has made me feel like I was on to something at least a little bit.
Emily Stewart is a senior correspondent at Vox, writing about and riding in rental cars. Thanks, Emily.
Thanks.
Coming up,
everyone likes Italian food. It's consistent.
Pizza, pasta, breadsticks, something for everyone to love, right? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 286 points, 0.9%, to close at 33,127. The NASDAQ dropped 202 points, 1.5%, to finish at 12,983. And the S&P 500 slid 53 points, 1.3%, to end at 4224. For the week, the Dow lost 1.6%, the NASDAQ slumped 3.2%, and the S&P 500 sunk 2.4%. Some of today's slide in the markets is being attributed to the fact that in the past 24 hours, the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield hit a 16-year high, crossing the 5% threshold for the first time since 2007. By market close today, the yield on that 10-year T-note was 4.91%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's ASCENSUS.com.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
Thank you. Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. Earlier this week, the Federal Reserve released its Summary of Commentary on Current Economic Conditions by Federal Reserve District, also known as the Beige Book. It's the seventh one out this year and includes local perspectives on the economy from folks all over the country. And one tidbit from the Philadelphia Fed caught our eye. A staffing firm in the region noted it's having an easier time finding employees who are willing to work weekend and night shifts. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes looks at why more people might be open to working non-traditional hours.
27-year-old Ness Madera Guerra started teaching trumpet at a music school in Naperville, Illinois last winter.
So you're articulating with the back of your tongue in order to get faster notes, so something like that.
But teaching alone wasn't earning Madera Guerra enough money. He's got $50,000 of student debt to pay back and a car in rough shape. So earlier this year, he took on a second job doing admin at the school. That means he works into the evenings and on weekends and misses out on life stuff.
I've had so many instances where friends or family ask me if I'm free to come to and, you know, hang out. I'm like, sorry, I can't. I have work.
Willingness to work when others are not may be telling us that the once very tight labor market is loosening up, says Penn State Abington economics professor Lonnie Golden.
People are reconsidering their income needs and maybe could find ways to time their classes, time their childcare to what the employers are offering.
And for some employers, weekend and night work is what they have to offer. That's true for Rob Sieben, who runs 15 flea markets around the country, where you can score anything from a diamond engagement ring to a lunchbox featuring an old TV show.
There was one I remember, the Partridge Family, which was really kind of fun.
Sieben needs workers to load items in and out, serve food, and clean up overnight. To make those jobs more attractive, he started offering workers their pay right after their shift, as opposed to 2 weeks later. And he says in the past 5 months, hiring has gotten a bit easier.
We are seeing people come saying, listen, you know, it's just harder for me to stay ahead, so I'm looking for a part-time job.
There are other perks, too. Sieben offers profit sharing and insurance, and he says sellers will sometimes leave their wares behind. So weekend workers may get a chance to score a Partridge Family lunchbox. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Like we were talking about at the top of the show, here in Washington, a lot of divisions are on very public display, mostly the partisan divisions. But even outside the Beltway, our country is divided in many different ways. You can call it modern-day segregation by race, political party, and socioeconomic status. A couple of researchers recently looked at places where people are most and least segregated, and they found when it comes to income, locations close to home, parks, pharmacies, schools, tend to be the most segregated because people with similar incomes tend to live near one another. But the researchers also looked at where people come together. Esther Yoon-ji Kang from WBEZ takes it from here.
On a cool and drizzly fall day, a couple settles into a booth for lunch at an Applebee's in Chicago.
Today I'm off work. Most of the time when I'm off work, I come in with my wife.
60-year-old construction worker James Williams loves Applebee's $12.99 boneless wings and says the restaurant has the best spinach dip in town.
They have decent deals and they have great prices. Oh, and they have great drinks.
Applebee's has another thing going for it. It represents one of the few places in the U.S. where people from all kinds of economic backgrounds come together.
Full-service, sit-down restaurant chains.
Maxim Masenkov co-authored the recent working paper titled Rubbing Shoulders. He teaches economics at the Naval Postgraduate School in California. He studied cell phone data to find places where folks with different incomes might interact and maybe even become friends. Masenkoff expected those places might be churches or libraries. Nope.
Places like Olive Garden, Applebee's, and Chili's.
That's where people from the top and bottom income percentiles are most likely to mix. The researchers then connected their data with a study about cross-class Facebook friendships. Turns out those relationships happen in areas with lots of chain restaurants.
It's not saying that if you randomly plop an Olive Garden or an Applebee's somewhere, that you'll see a whole bunch of really beautiful new friendships blossom, but it's consistent with that idea.
Over his plate of wings, construction worker James Williams says he loves coming to Applebee's because of the service.
They treat me the same as if I was a regular guy just walking off the street. You have to accommodate the rich, the poor, they have decent everything, so this worked for me.
I ask him if he's ever made new friends here.
Well, I'm not that kind of a guy, so... Well, I met you.
Well, I came to you.
Yeah, but you're friendly. You seem like a nice lady.
I took my nice lady self later that evening and went to Olive Garden in Burbank, just outside of Chicago.
Can I get the never-ending soup, salad, and breadsticks?
Okay, what would you like?
All around, there are tables full of grandparents, kids, white people, black people, Latinos, chatting and enjoying giant plates of spaghetti and chicken Alfredo. While I wait for my minestrone soup, I head outside and meet Valentin Rodriguez, who had just finished dinner with his son. I ask him why he comes to Olive Garden.
Everyone likes Italian food. It's consistent.
The eggplant parmigiana will taste the same at an Olive Garden here in Chicago as it does in Bismarck, North Dakota. Variety is also part of the broad appeal. There's something for everyone in those giant menus. And Olive Garden hostess Ruth Gonzalez says the atmosphere here is kind of like family for both workers and diners.
Some people have many different backgrounds, and we have many regulars coming in every day.
In her 2 years working there, she says she has seen customers forging relationships.
Sometimes like they'll like bump into each other and be like, oh, like I just saw you last time. And then like they actually do become friends, and then you'll see them coming in together another time.
And that's kind of what the study's researchers are talking about. Not to say bottomless wings and unlimited breadsticks are the answer to segregation, but maybe they're one way to bring people from different backgrounds together. In Chicago, I'm Esther Yunji Kang for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, Tyson Foods, known for its beef, pork, and chicken, is expanding into another type of protein, insects. The company announced this week it's investing in a Dutch company called Protix. The two businesses will work together to build and operate a U.S. facility that will use food manufacturing byproducts to feed bugs, which can be turned into food for our food, like fish and livestock feed, as well as pet food. Here's your moment of economic context today, which comes via Axios. According to the climate think tank Ember, about half of the world's countries are already over the hump when it comes to generating electricity from fossil fuels, and have been for about 5 years, meaning that the world overall is getting close to peak fossil fuel electricity, with the idea and the hope that as that trend line goes down, usage of cleaner energy keeps trending up. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. And I'm Kimberly Adams. Hope you have a great weekend, and we will be back on Monday. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work. while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.